This edition of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 14th of September 2014 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to edition 271 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tuck.
Coming up on the show, we look to the future with former CIA intelligence analyst Matthew Burrows, who writes the trend reports for the White House. He published a book about his work and will be here to tell us all about his trade.
Then we talk money, or better, we unpick the lingo that makes the realm of the economic elite so exclusive. John Lanchester came by to teach us some phrases.
And later in the programme, we get our long-lusted after gin. Distillery founder Alex Walpert will be here with bottles and stories of his new East London liquor company.
That is all coming up here on the Monocle Weekly with me, Robert Bounds, and Andrew Tugg. What a week we've had, Andrew. We've been out on the road. We've kind of started the grand tour for the Monocle Guide to Better Business. That's the book that's available in all good record shops. I'm joking.
We were in Berlin at the beginning of the week with our fine friends at Gestalt and the publishers at the Bikini Building, where they have their new store and cafe. And we did a great party. We met lots of really nice people and signed lots of books. And it was a great start. And then the next day, the train headed off to Paris, and then the following day to Antwerp. So we've done the first three cities. And you, straight after this show.
Yeah, I'm going to be seeing. I wonder. Hopefully, there are some listeners tuned in. I'm going to see you tomorrow evening in Kuala Lumpur, and then the next evening in Singapore, and then you retake the baton in Tokyo, don't you?
Yes. So on goes the tour, and it will do it all the way through to Christmas. So well, good luck in Kuala Lumpur. That's going to be fun.
Much. Yeah, that'd be good. I might. I know you've got a little bit of a catchphrase. Going on.
I haven't got a catchphrase. I'm not giving away my catchphrase.
He's got really angry. all right, well, I won't say it. All I'm saying is, our Tokyo listeners, will hear it on is it Wednesday or Thursday night, and I might shot it out.
It's yours to use.
Can I use it?
Yeah, it's a good description of the book.
All right, that's a good
description. People liked it. It went down well. But if you reveal that I say it every single time, then it might not work.
You don't say it every single time. It won't. So it's not as if there is an Andrew Tuck Monocle Guide to Better Business drinking game.
No, not the well. Okay.
We can drink for the catchphrase.
Well, we are going to be having some drinking. Well, it was good last week. We talked about the fact that we'd like to get some more gin on here to kind of mix things up.
Help things along on a Sunday afternoon.
And lo and behold, we have a gin guest.
We do. We've got the founder of the East London Distillery.
I saw him outside chilling his bottles. I'm looking forward to seeing him come in.
I love it when you can hear a guest turn up, because I can hear the clanking of him taking the bottles out the boot of his car.
It's going to be a fine
show.
Who needs
books? I feel like Toad of Toad Hall. Who needs a canary yellow caravan when you can have a motor car?
So there are a few things between here and the gin. Should we get one of them out of the way?
Tedwoods.
Let's get him in.
Baby. Who knew the news could be so hot? Delivering a look ahead to the week's events, here's Tom Edwards.
Baby. Hello, Tom.
Hi, Rob. Hi, Andrew.
We were just talking about being on the road, and you were on the road with us. You were in Paris.
That's right. What a beautiful, the city of lights.
You were just there for 1 week.
Just under a week, Andrew, yeah. That's right.
Do you want to explain to us what happened to your girlfriend's shoe?
Did you even know about that?
What's going on here? I didn't know about this.
No, tell the story. The shoe story is good.
Yeah.
Okay, well, a nameless hotel in Paris in the 13th. Narrow it down a bit. They gathered my lady friend's shoe in with the laundry and dispatched it to an as yet unknown location.
Really?
So she came back to the room and there was one shoe.
Just one shoe.
Was she hopping?
With all the other shoes. She was hopping mad.
Whee!
No, they've pledged to assist me in some way.
Right.
Answer as yet has come there none.
Have you had to prove that its sister was a Christian Louboutin and that you need to be paid back in full?
Compensated accordingly. Yeah. No, but I apparently need to produce a receipt.
What?
Or for the shoe? And prove that you haven't got a one-legged lady as a girlfriend.
Exactly, yeah. So, worried that if it all gets messy, end up in the courts. I don't think they have a leg to stand on. A shoe to stand on, perhaps.
Oh, my God.
That's right. That's right. I'm setting the bar that low.
Oh, look at how I queued that one up for you.
It's a Sunday. It's a Sunday. Come on.
Okay, let's do some news. What's going to happen this week?
Okay, well, we'll start with today. Busy day of elections all around. Swedish general elections, very interesting. You know, centre-right on the way out, centre-left on the way in. End of sort of political career, like sort of Carl Bildt could be coming. We'll be analysing all of that tomorrow. Other interesting elections, like you get these Sundays periodically. You've got Afghan elections, German state votes, and Russia regional local elections, the Moscow Duma. So lots of interesting ones which we'll be unpicking in the next couple of days.
That's a story that sort of really needs an infographic, isn't it?
It would be. I tried to present that as a sort of sonic gesticulation. But again,
I like your gesticulation.
They're lost. They're lost on the listening audience. I need to get to grips with that.
Jon Snow in his swingometer.
And I like the way he said Duma elections and looked at you for your kind of follow-on question.
I love the Duma. I love the Duma. I love the Knesset. I love all the funny named parliaments.
The Taoiseach.
The Taoiseach, I don't know that which one that is. What's that?
The Taoiseach. Well, he's the Irish Premier.
Oh, him, yes. The Taoiseach.
Fiendishly complicated. I'll tell you what else is complicated. Political happenings. In France, obviously, I was just in Paris. I was talking to the likes of Christine Ocron, Tom Bowes Watson, friends and colleagues here at Monocle about the difficulties confronting Manuel
Valls.
It
wasn't just the people at Dolce's you were talking
about. Exactly. I sought the views of everyone on how to get my shoes back.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Manuel Valls, he's in all sorts of bother. The French National Assembly is going to hold a vote of confidence in the government again on Tuesday. The president has an all-time low approval ratings, I think below 15%, extraordinary figures. Not much better for Manuel Valls. He's already had to preside over two different governments. French politics is in real mire at the moment.
Oh, you wouldn't want to be the president, would you?
It's not easy to get excited about, is it?
It's not.
Well, knock that one back, fine. No, I mean, that's the politician's trouble.
and yet you find they have great problems in France.
But
this leads me on to my next item, which is there are politicians who are seizing the metal, if you will, and are managing to make politics a lot more exciting. Right here in the UK, of course, Scottish independence vote on Thursday. We've been covering this in a lot of details. We've got some special documentary made by my colleague Thomas Lewis, which we're going to be playing just in the days before. Hugely significant. And I don't think people, perhaps certainly, there was a degree of complacency here in London, certainly at Westminster. The no vote will easily prevail. That's what the polls were suggesting. And obviously it's all got a lot closer. And the ripples from this could be felt fairly widely across Europe, because there's a number of different countries or regions, perhaps we should say, who'll be likely to push maybe more of a secessionist agenda.
Yeah, and I think the mistake on both sides for the Scotland debate is that it's been about, you know, will you be richer or poorer? But in the end, people don't care about that. The people care about, you know, do we want to be self-governing or do we want to be a part of a broader union? And the emotional bit was the thing that was never touched on. And that's, I think, how the kind of no campaign has ended up a bit kind of stuck, because, you know, people get bored of being, you know, people trying to frighten them.
Also, there's that strange thing of campaigning for the word no.
Yeah.
It's a strangely negative thing, isn't it? I mean, I've thought of this throughout this campaign, that yes, it's easier to get people to say yes, perhaps, no matter what it is. It's a bizarre thing.
Yeah, it should have been yes to the union.
Yeah,
no, not to the union.
Yeah. I wonder how they established that. Well, I forgive my ignorance.
But it's a really interesting question. I think that Salmond and the secessionists got onto that thing very quickly. To make it a yes thing, to make it a positive thing to want to leave rather than a negative thing to want to stay. I think that's really interesting.
No, it's fascinating. Well, and you know, all the eyes of, well, I was going to say Britain, but it's Europe. Actually, the world will certainly be on it, because it will send such an interesting message about what the position of the United Kingdom is going forward. So intriguing stuff. That's on Thursday. A bit of levity. Shall we end a couple of slightly lighter items? Also on Thursday, there's the Ig Nobel Prize. You know, this ceremony where they invite actual Nobel laureates to present awards. The idea being scientists who do something that's quite literally risible initially, but then actually makes people think in a bit more detail. They have less than a minute to explain their work and why it's relevant. All sorts of things, science, medicine, technology. 1,200 scientists will be there to see who wins. And there have been some ridiculous experiments down the years, but they're always quite good fun. I'm thinking of my personal favourite a couple of years ago. There was someone who'd been magnetically levitating frogs.
That's good, isn't it?
Now, why?
Is that to see if you can do it with people, presumably? Well, you've got a big enough magnet.
I don't know. You probably just... It sounds like... They all sound like things people are doing just as a dare.
We're definitely still on... We're not on this... We're still on this item. We're still not... We're not on this, your second news item. That'd be a great way of making the election a bit more interesting.
Exactly. Okay. It's Manuel Valls' last ditch bid to spice things up in Paris. And finally, I know that you've got a bit of a drinking theme, perhaps later in the show.
Yes, we're going to have a gin tasting.
You're going to have gin tasting. So I thought... For those people maybe who aren't necessarily fans of the spirits, but fans instead of, well, the beer, nothing better than Oktoberfest that kicks off next Saturday. Mm. The world's largest drinking festival, I believe, certainly the world's largest beer festival. 2 weeks of frenetic drinking.
I haven't had my stag yet.
Throughout Bavaria. Rob, that's got your name all over it.
And a fine excuse to slip on some leather shorts.
My friend Max bought some because he does quite. He's a banker based in Switzerland. He's not Swiss, but he does quite a lot of business in the German speaking cantons and in Germany. And he had to basically. It was either hire a lederhosen or buy your own.
You've got to buy it.
You've got to buy your own, haven't you? Yeah. It's kind of like ski boots. You don't know what's gone on in there before. Yeah. So yeah. So imagine buying that. Imagine kind of having to get one for work. Imagine expensing that, Andrew. I wonder if I can do it.
One pair leather shorts. I think it's going to look a bit odd, Rob. But you can have a go.
Give it a try. Food for thought, anyway.
What about Reynolds expensing one shoe?
Yeah, exactly. Imagine. Tom, I loved your news look ahead. It did genuinely have light and shade. Not as much as I'm looking forward to the gin tasting later on, of course.
That's right. Well, you know, gentlemen, remember, it's only, what are we? It's only just after lunchtime.
I know. Stick around.
Take it easy. Or maybe I'll see if I can make off with one of those samples later.
Yeah.
Yeah, you stick around. Poor old Rob, he can't have too much. He's getting on that plane. He might get emotional.
Tom, thank you very much.
Pleasure as always.
We live in an unpredictable world between spreading disease, civil wars in the Middle East, and the crisis in eastern Ukraine. We wish that someone would foresee the way that the world is headed so that those who listen could prepare for the unexpected. But does anyone know? And does anyone listen to those who do?
Someone who knows all about global trends is Matthew Burrows, former CIA intelligence analyst and author of the book The Future Declassified. He also oversees the creation of the Global Trend Report, the key futurist guide for the White House. And Matthew joins us in the studio now. Perhaps you could just explain a little bit the background to this book, because these reports, you know, you've briefed numerous presidents in the United States. The reports that you've done have now been fleshed out into a book. Could you just tell us a little about the genesis of this?
So, as you mentioned, I was a longtime career officer at the CIA, and one of our duties, actually, when I was in the National Intelligence Council, was to put together reports looking out 15, 20 years to help the president at the very beginning of his administration really begin the usual strategic reviews that happen at that point. And, you know, afterwards, they tend to get very much dragged down into a crisis, and there's a lot that the president has to do. So at that, you know, succeeding years after the first one, they're usually much more interested in the here and now, not the broad, long-term trends.
And would you say that the report that was given to presidents initially between election and inauguration, that were these the views then of the CIA? Were these the concerns of the CIA about, you know, politics and trends in society that were unfolding?
Well, we tried to be very objective, and actually there is much the views of the intelligence community as they were of also experts around the world. And one of the things that the president and his senior foreign policy team are very interested in is how others in the world look up upon these future trends, or how they would think about their own chances in the world. We went to 20 countries in doing the last one, engaged with Russians, Chinese. I mean, this was a very broad-based effort.
Well, it's a fascinating thing because each chapter in the book sort of sets out a line of thought or a line of inquiry about, you know, whether we mentioned in the introduction, different nation states, threats and opportunities, diseases, you know, war in the Middle East, civil war in the Middle East, all these things. Does it become not in your head, Matthew, probably, but like trying to put a quart into a pint pot, you know, that you kind of, you might nail one subject, but of course it leaks into the next one. Disease can lead to a civil war, and this can lead to the economic conditions might prevail over all of these things. Do all of these things, I know you've written a book, so they have to fit into neat chapters, but is it a broad brushstroke of knowledge across all of these things?
Well, the idea was actually to put together a mental framework about how you could think about the, you know, the next 15, 20 years, because obviously you can't predict all the different incidents that could happen. But you want to give some sense of what are the certainties and then what are the uncertainties. And of course, a lot that the president and his team would have to deal with are really in the uncertainties category. So you can give examples, and these are really the scenarios of how things could go wrong, but sometimes how they could go right. I mean, because I wouldn't want to leave the impression that everything is going to hell in a handbasket in this work. I mean, there's a lot that we need to worry about, but in terms of the age that we live in, you know, it is the best age that we've ever seen in human history.
Yeah, and it's an interesting, I mean, you say that it's an interesting thing with knowing your background in this, you know, the CIA, and that it is a fretful organization rather than necessarily looks for opportunities, right?
Yes, I mean, that's our job, or that's the CIA's job. But it was our job, or my job in this book and also in the reports to put that in context. You know, what are the things that you really have to worry about versus what are, you know, all sorts of things that are going to happen that you know, may be concerning for a day or a week or a month, but what are the existential changes really that are happening? Some of them good, some of them bad. And then how do you, some idea of how you would prevent them or how you would shape those developments so they wouldn't go in the worst possible case.
I want to pick up some of the key examples you have. But first, I just want to ask you about what's happening, you know, right now in the world. We have the Islamic State or ISIS causing huge problems in Syria, in Iraq. We have leaders scrambling for a response to that. It feels that they've been taken off guard by many of the things that have unfolded over the past few months. You know, an organization that, in fact, in most people's mind, well, wasn't in most lay people's minds, certainly even 6 months ago. When we look at what's happening in eastern Ukraine, again, did we really think that Russia would be so bullish about taking back territory there? Do you feel that sometimes events, you know, no matter how good you are looking at the future, trying to discern trends, that these things just come along and, you know, change the agenda with almost no predictability?
Well, I think they have some predictability, but I think you're entirely right that once they occur, they oftentimes have a dynamic of their own. Because when you think of, you know, the classic case would be 9/11 in the U.S., if that wouldn't have happened, I mean, if it would have been prevented, then I think you wouldn't have had an Iraqi invasion. So there are things that really set in motion. Now, I think in the Middle East, I mean, that I am very pessimistic. I mean, that is one area where I think, as I talk about, there's a scenario there about a crisis in the Middle East leading eventually to nuclear war. I mean, I think that's where you can be very pessimistic. And so far, the worst case has happened. Ukraine, Russia, I'm a little bit less so, because I think in the end, Russia is going to pay a high price for what it's done and may have to backtrack.
In terms of the years and in terms of the predictions that your book makes, how far can you go? How far does the prediction turn into a crystal ball, Matthew, if you know what I mean? And how far also does it depend upon who is commissioning you to make that research?
It never becomes a crystal ball in the sense that, you know, I can foretell that on such and such a day this will happen.
he looks a lot like Nostradamus, doesn't he?
I mean, believe me, you know, the various administrations would love that. I mean, if you could do it, but I mean, you can't. As I said, you can provide a certain framework to think about it so that, you know, these are the things that are most uncertain that could happen. Can't necessarily be foretold. I mean, there are other things that there's a certain, you know, greater predictability about it. I mean, thing, the general trends, I would say, even on the economic side. you know, there's a greater predictability.
I wanted to ask you about one of those, actually, because on the China story, there's some fascinating things in there about China. And one of the elements you talk about is whether there is a pressure in China for more individualism and whether there is therefore a pressure for a more democratic kind of China and what that would cause to unfold in China. And I think you give a figure which I had never seen given so bluntly, which you say roughly $15,000. Once income hits that level, then people's desire for personal freedom goes over a threshold. And that's kind of roughly where China is getting to. When you look at China and you paint some really fascinating images of what could happen to China, do you see that as a nation like the old Soviet Union that is kind of ready to pull apart? Do you think that it is a nation that will, in the end, embrace democracy?
I'm probably among the optimists on China. And the reason I say that is because probably of all the places I went to when I did the reports, I mean, the Chinese are very aware of the trends. And a lot of that is, you know, in the party, they're trying to prevent some of the democracy trends. But there also is an understanding that there are going to be those pressures. And they're the ones that have done conferences on democracy. I mean, they're trying to get at how the party, obviously, can survive in a much more liberalized political atmosphere. So I think those pressures will build. The worry now is that their growth rate is beginning to come down, which was predicted. It's not something that is out of the ordinary. They've gone at a terrific rate, unprecedented, the amount of growth they've had. But you've had rising expectations. So can the party continue to fulfill those economic expectations?
I wanted to ask you before we finish, Matthew, also about allies. I mean, your book analyzes threat quite a lot, but what about opportunity and allies? Do you see the United States, perhaps the UK, European nations as well, being allied with some surprising pals in the next 15, 20 years, perhaps?
Well, certainly, you know, the U.S.-China relationship, I mean, it has its problems, but in many ways, I mean, if you think back to, you know, before the First World War, you had this rivalry between Britain and Germany at the time, which was one of the ingredients in setting off the war. And you don't have that, even though we're very diverse, different cultures, different traditions. So I think in many ways we are odd bedfellows. I think there's going to be still problems in the relationship. But I think it is one of those surprising partnerships that really has been established. And again, I'm hopeful that we can work through those problems so you don't have a conflict, you don't repeat what happened with the First World War.
Maybe just quickly and finally, you also talk a great deal about what the future is for America. And I imagine if you're a US president, that's part of the trend reporting that you would be most keen to read. You talk about the fact that in the past, Americans have often felt that things will kind of come good in the end, and you're getting to a point where you can't rely on that being the reality. Do you think there is, for America, therefore, a very changed role around the corner, or do you feel that America can maintain that greatness and that authority if it realizes this is a changed world, as you describe here in the book?
I think we have that opportunity. I'm not sure, and that was really the reason for writing the book, I'm not sure Americans understand just how much the context has changed and how much, you know, the U.S. role has to change with that context. I mean, we are no longer the unipolar power, and we have to, I think, be more like the master of ceremonies in a sense of arranging, managing things so they don't get off track. At the same time, there's a lot that has to be done domestically. I mean, we are in a much more economically competitive world. And the U.S. really hasn't, you know, in terms of education, hasn't really kept up with that. And we have, you know, some risks that we won't be able to keep up to the level that I think would satisfy Americans' expectations. One of the disturbing facts, I think, that I write about in the book is the fact that the middle class really has taken a beating in the last decade or two from globalization. You know, U.S. as a whole has done extremely well. The very rich have done very, very well out of this. But the kind of middle class, their incomes have stagnated.
Well, the answers to that and many more things beside are in The Future Declassified. The author is Matthew Burrows. Matthew, thank you very much for joining us on the Monocle Weekly.
Oh, thank you very much.
Indigo and lavender are the ingredients for success for two entrepreneurs based in Wales. We travel through Valley and Dale to meet a jeans maker and a lavender farmer getting it right.
It turned out, you know, everybody loved to come and actually see lavender oil being distilled right here in Wales. So somehow there's a holistic thing going on here that's about the lavender, about distilling, and about a way of life in these hills.
Made in Wales, now playing in the films menu at monocle.com.
Now, the world of finance is an exclusive one, guarded not only by high towers and ruthless bankiers, but also by the language of the economic elite. Jargon-filled and complex, very few of us actually know what a dead cat bounce is.
So if we don't understand what financiers are talking about, how are we supposed to make the right decisions when it comes to lawmaking and voting? John Lanchester has written a new book called How to Speak Money, and Marcus Hippie and Andrew spoke to him earlier.
John, thank you very much for coming to see us. The book is great and fascinating and entertaining, but why do you think it is that it takes an outsider from the money world to look at all these terms that kind of slightly bamboozle us? And, you know, I think you often, when you read financial reports, you kind of know what some of these things are. But why does it take an outsider, do you think, to bring some clarity to this world?
I think it's partly because the language is so powerful and so useful to people who speak it. The penny first dropped for me at a thing called Kilconomics, which is, it's a very Irish thing, the world's first ever festival of comedy and economics. And I was at the first one in Kilkenny in 2010. And it mixed comedians and economists. And when the economists were talking, they had this tendency to sort of turn towards each other. Their body language actually was sort of turning inwards. And they started speaking, they suddenly talking about the effect of QE2 on M3 and things like that. And you suddenly, the audience lost them, and at which point the comedian would make a joke and would force them to reconnect. I think it's rooted in the fact that for insiders and who speak it, it's a very powerful, very ironically economic form of communication.
I just wonder sometimes when you hear people using this language, you know, whether it's, you know, sociologists or urbanists, they often use this kind of language also to dress up for something that's quite basic in its essence, to make it sound a bit more scientific and a bit more thought out. Do you think there's an element of that as well, that they want to sound that this is very considered and important, where in fact they're guessing like many other people?
I think there sometimes is. There's a very funny thing of Grayson Perry's. He talks about international art English, which is the way you talk about the vocabulary of art, which is, you know, a lot of which is absolute Horlicks from the common sense point of view, but it makes it sound more, you know, talking about volumes of spaces and blah, blah, blah. And there is an element of deliberate bamboozlement about some of it, I think.
John, what do you think? What are the most misleading expressions?
The single biggest switch, I think, is there used to be this thing that was very, very bad that, you know, aristocrats didn't mind, but the middle and working classes both had a terror of this thing called debt. Debt was a bad thing. Debt cast a shadow of your life. You weren't living your own life properly if you were in servitude to debt. And at some point, that gets turned into a thing called credit, which is really good, which you want, and which offers you a sense of expansion and possibility and gearing up your income and living the life that would otherwise be slightly out of reach. So although it sounds like a joke, and in a way it is a joke, and it sounds like a small thing, actually I think it has massive consequences for framing things about life and about your personal finances. That thing that used to be debt, now being called credit, which I think started to happen roughly in the 80s.
And that's, I guess, around the time we had the big bang here with Thatcher in Britain, for example, and financial services went from being a thing that gentlemen did from the shires, and, you know, there was a stockbroker belt, till it was this very kind of different world. And do you think some of that kind of the energy of, you know, young people who came into the business kind of brought with them new lexicons and new ways of making up words?
I think it did a bit. It certainly brought a new sense of energy and a new sort of sense of velocity and speed and maybe aggression. 1986 was a big bang, and certainly I think the city was a much less clubby place after that. I mean, it's a proper meritocracy, as everyone said. You know, it's really open to talents. It isn't about who you know in any way at all. But I wonder if some of the energy actually is also linguistic, comes from roughly then.
What's your conclusion? How much on purpose has this development happened? The language has become so difficult and so full of jargon.
I think it's hard to know. I think what I'd say about that, Marcus, is that intention doesn't really matter, because if you are bamboozled and excluded and just don't know what words mean, it doesn't really matter if someone's, as it were, done it on purpose or whether it's an accidental consequence of insiders speaking an inside technical jargon. I think, you know, if you end up with something like in the credit crunch, you had super synthetic CDSs made of synthetic CDOs that were in turn based on RMBS. You know, it doesn't matter if someone is deliberately throwing sand in your eyes or not. The net effect of that is that you haven't the faintest idea what they're talking about.
Now, so the book is literally, you know, an A to Z of the words that are used in banking and beyond. And we must say it's done with a huge amount of humour in the right places as well. But some of these words are words that I didn't know. So, and I don't want to test you here, but fungible is a word I'd not heard. But could you explain what, you actually do say that fungible is a bit hard to explain.
Yeah, in fact, when I was, I had a text from Brian Appleyard from the Sunday Times while I was writing it and replied back, you know, sorry, I'm just trying to define fungible. And he immediately texted back, can be turned into a funge. It's anything that you can swap for another different amount of the same thing without loss or changing value. So coins are fungible with cash notes, which are, you know, fungible in any direction. A £10 note is fungible with a £50 note or a 1p coin or a 2p coin. And things like commodities, but copper is fungible, doesn't matter how much you're swapping for how much, gold. But things with kind of particular qualities or identities of their own, for instance, books aren't fungible. One book isn't worth the same as another book.
And one other, just before I let Marcus back in, the hot waitress index.
I was looking for a thing where they have all these largely fanciful things about, you know, the crane index, which is really sort of basic thing about how many cranes you can see, how hard it is to get a taxi. And there's one about, you know, short skirts getting shorter in recessions. And the hot waitress index is the nakedly sexist thing I heard from a Wall Streeter. And it was the idea that you can tell when a recession is about to hit because the young women who would have been getting jobs as models and actresses can't because everything's slowing down, so they're working as waitresses. So it's the idea that you can tell from, you know, the check-in counter of your hotel whether there's a recession about to hit.
What I was thinking myself when I was going through that vocabulary was the power of simplifying things. There are expressions I'd always thought I kind of know what they mean, but when I was reading your explanations, I realized that things are so much more complicated than that. Is it a problem that we think kind of the simpler way?
I think a lot of the time, in an ideal life, maybe you'd never think about money. I think that's part of it. There's quite a sort of strong human impulse just to not think about it. And I think if we were all content, you know, money wouldn't feature that much. So I do think there's a sort of default setting where there's a percentage of the population who are completely obsessed with it and think about nothing else. And then the rest of us sort of by preference don't. I think that's quite a strong impulse.
I also like the word bankster, which is you know, another word which I had thought was a fresh term, but you point out it actually came from the Great Depression.
Yes, I put that in fact, because I think everyone, you can immediately tell what bankster means, but it's so striking that it comes from the 20s.
The other thing is, I think often when you meet people at parties, and I'm trying to find the right word here, you ask people what they do, and they're in derivatives or they're in gilts. And that's when I get lost. That's when I have to try and think up a second question because I'm a bit stuck after the first one. In a way, bankster hints how the kind of public sees that world. But when people describe their own careers often, it must be tricky doing something that you can't quite explain to people what you do. And is that the root of the problem with all the banking crisis? That in fact, lots of people don't quite know how to explain what they're up to.
I think a bit. I mean, I think if that feeds through into, you know, say the legislative framework around banking, if MPs are like the rest of us and don't quite know what's going on, it's quite difficult to design laws if you literally don't know what they're doing. And I think a lot of what happened with the move towards deregulation, which in essence was a move towards the financial industry writing its own rules for how it should behave, I think was based on exactly that. You had literally lawmakers literally not knowing what was going on, what they were writing rules about. And I think the default thing of that to, you know, let the insiders create their own framework. I mean, we see very clearly where that ended up.
Well, since it's so important to understand these things and understand that language, I'm wondering why it's not taught more widely, and do you think this could one day change?
I think, you know, when the notion of kind of core curriculum focusing on skills, this kind of slightly esoteric, industry-specific knowledge, you know, hasn't featured very prominently. I think it was a striking thing. You had in the Soviet Union, you had lessons on communism, how communism was supposed to work, starting at primary school. And there's no equivalent under free market capitalism. There's nothing explaining how the system's supposed to work. Of course, the way communism was supposed to work was almost entirely a work of fiction. That's not a brilliant example, but it is noticeable that there is no education in, you know, quite basic things like compound interest, which most insiders say, and if you have to explain things to do with personal finance, the single most important thing is the power of compound interest. That's the thing that we should all sort of instinctively know, the way that they do, the money people do. And I think for the most part, we sort of don't.
Can I ask you, you've written about this world and what happened after the great shakedown, as it were. Do you feel that, a bigger question here, but do you feel that the world of banking has changed forever? Or because we look at our newspapers and we look at the headlines, and for many people in the public, it feels that the game didn't really change as much as they anticipated. Governments are still scared to come in with legislation. All the things we heard that were going to happen about bonuses and things didn't quite come to fruition. Has that world changed? Is that reflected in the language? Or do you feel that it is kind of quietly business as usual?
I think it is quietly business as usual. That's not what people in it say. I mean, bankers all complain about there being a lot more annoying small rules and a lot more red tape. And the term that a lot of them use is that it's much less fun than it was. I think we, the public, probably don't mind it being much less fun for them than it was. But I think the broad principles of the kind of architecture and of the system and pay/bonuses, there was a move to crack down on bonuses, so they simply increased pay. How does that help? And so I think that the broad principles are largely in place. And I think there's a very general sense, which I think is actually accurate, that in lots of ways, it's actually still 2008, in terms of the big broad principles of the system and how it works, and how the banks work. Actually, it's a weird form of non-time travel. We're actually still living in 2008.
As Andrew mentioned earlier, you are kind of an outsider. You don't come from a financial background. And what you've been doing earlier instead is working as a football reporter, obituary writer, book editor, restaurant critic even, and so forth. What kind of a path has it been for you to actually learn all this language? And how confident do you feel now? Do you feel that you actually understand everything that's going on, say, in the city?
Certainly not. And one of the ways I know that is that whenever there's a new scandal or implosion, it's quite often something you'd never heard of. I did know what LIBOR was, but, things like forward settling ETF derivatives, which were that thing when JP Morgan lost, first they said it was a tempest in a teacup, then it turned out it was $8 billion. So not such a tempest in a teacup. And that was something called forward, what's a forward settling ETF derivative? And then you have something like fixing another scandal, I think Barclays fixing the gold spot price. What's that? So very far from knowing all of it. And the reason I can tell is that, it's usually to do with scandals and implosions. But in terms of a broad overall sense of it, I do feel, I'm not exactly confident, but, I just noticed that I have to look less things up than I used to do 10 years ago.
And just tell us, as a writer, did this subject grasp you because you were annoyed or because you were kind of fascinated? Marcus alludes there to your work in football and food. You were very well known as a food critic. Is that because you become passionate about something and you want to know everything and to understand it, and then you slightly move on a little bit? Or what piqued your interest in this?
I mean, it's a sort of blessing and a curse of being a writer that you end up writing about your interests. You end up following your interests, and to some extent you slightly use them up. I mean, I was obsessed with football back in the days when I wrote about it, and I did slightly burn out. The effect of writing match reports was I still like it, but it's not like it was. And similarly with food, writing about restaurants and so on, actually one of the reasons I stopped was because it was on the cusp of ceasing to be a pleasure. That if you have a really instrumental attitude to your own interests, your interests actually then turning into your work, some of the joy leaks out of it. And I ended up writing about this because I was writing a big fat novel about London. And if you're interested in London, you end up being interested in finance. You have to be, because it's so central to what the modern city now is. And I was very, very interested, very excited to sort of find out this stuff. I'm less like that now because I'm sort of more in command of it. And I did end up writing this book. It's the first thing, I don't want to sound pompous, but first thing I've ever written that had a sense of sort of citizenly obligation about it, because I did feel I just kept being asked to explain things. That was the common thread. What's the explanation of X, Y, Z? And since I felt I sort of had some of that knowledge, I thought, well, actually, there seems to be an appetite for it, so therefore I should do it.
That was John Lanchester, and his book, How to Speak Money, came out last week.
Up next, we'll be joined by Alex Walput, the man who brought spirit manufacturing back to the East End, and we can't wait.
There's a new sound coming to Monocle 24.
This is Nick Luskin. Join me for new music from around the world, Wednesday, 1500 London time. We'll be bringing live sessions and interviews to the mix every week, and all kinds of wonderful artists and records that you might not know yet, but you're sure to love.
about brand new music from around the world. Monocle presents Nick Luscombe every Wednesday, 1500 hours London time.
Over the last few years, we've seen a renaissance of locally produced craft beers and spirits, first in the US and now in the UK as well. Not a month goes by, it seems, without another beardy beer maker popping out of a train arch in Hackney.
But East London does have a rich legacy in spirits making, something Alex Woolpert, founder of the East London Liquor Company, wanted to build on when he opened his distillery in the old glue factory in Bow Wharf this summer. He makes a very good-looking gin, whiskey and vodka. Welcome to the show, Alex. So first thing, let's just explain the revival of spirits making in London. Victorian times, the city was known for gin distilleries all over the place. They vanished, but there has been a renaissance in that. Why do you think that is?
I think the Renaissance started probably 5-10 years ago in the States, perhaps even longer. The States seem to be ahead of us in terms of this sort of craft, artisanal movement to make spirits on a much smaller scale, much more attention to detail. And we've seen that slowly filter back into the UK in terms of smaller distillers. Ian Hart with Sacred, Sipsmiths, Jensen's and Thames make several small batch individual gins for various different brands.
And what was your background that you made you think, I can elbow my way into the bar and start doing my own thing?
I was running a company called Barworks. There was 8 or 9 pubs, bars. I just thought that was a bit of a, funny enough, a gap in the market. You know, people say the market's saturated with gin, but I'm not sure it is really. I think there's certainly a sort of a niche there for spirits revival in East London to sort of really celebrate what used to be there. The last distillery in East London closed down in the early 1900s, and there isn't someone there, or there hasn't been someone there making gin, vodka and whiskey there for quite some time.
And the revival in gin, is that because it's actually one of the simpler spirits to make?
I mean, well, there's no aging as such. I mean, it takes us probably 6 to 8 hours to run a batch of 500-600 bottles of gin. We can bottle it the same day or the next day, and it's ready to go out that week.
And what makes the difference between two gins?
So it's basically the botanical mix and what the flavour profile is. I wanted to do a sort of classic London dry gin in terms of flavour profile, but also celebrate what gin could be as an ingredient for a martini.
I'm going to say that when I come back from lunch, when you go, "You're right, Rob." And I go, "What's the difference between two gins?"
Now, while Rob's clawing...
Yeah, thank you very much for your answer.
While Rob's clawing at the desk, I think you should probably pop one of these fine beauties. You've got two styles of bottle, first of all.
Well, I'm going to start with a vodka, if that's all right. I know we're talking about gin, but we're using the same Utrecht-grown spirit base, which is 100% British wheat. And what's special about that is that it's carefully sourced, we know where it comes from, and it's a very good quality Utrecht-grown spirit. Which means that, here's me saying I can open a bottle easily, now eating my words, and the bottle top in a minute.
So I see that it's childproof anyway.
It's good. Childproof,
that's
exactly.
Number one. Well, let's dish it out.
So tell us what we should be looking out for when we taste this.
There's a couple of things in terms of how we make it and what we use to make it, which defines the flavour. We use British wheat grain spirit, and wheat grain spirits have usually a couple of key tasting notes. Perhaps I should wait until you've...
Yeah, let's have a...
Wow, that's got this strong aroma.
There's a kind of corniness to it. There's a kind of like green corniness.
But what's quite nice is it's quite soft as well. It's not that normal. Ooh,
there's no hit. There's no kind of ouch.
No, there's no hit. No, it's smooth.
So that smooth, buttery, almost kind of creamy quality, and the heat that comes is an aniseedy heat, not a...
Yeah. An alcoholic heat.
Those are the characteristics of a wheat grain spirit.
Is it mainly bars that you're distributing through? Or?
Bars, off-licences, hotels, restaurants. It's always hard to get through the door, but once people try the liquid, it's much easier. The botanicals are on the back or the front of the bottle. There's no secret ingredient. There's no mystical process. You can walk into the distillery, there's a glass wall, you sit at the bar, you drink our gin, you watch it being made. We bottle it on site. We have a fully automated bottling line. Everything happens there.
So you're keen for the public to come into the building?
Absolutely, yeah. We do tours and we're really keen for people to come in and ask us as many questions as they like.
What next?
What would you recommend? I mean, that's...
What next?
Someone's thirsty.
While you're opening... No, I'm not. While you're opening the next one, there are certain types of vodka and gin. Sure. So many people, especially in the UK, like to certainly just mix them with tonic or whatever.
Sure.
What are the drinks that highlight how good your stuff is as opposed to masking it?
So all our gins are London dry in terms of their specification.
Rather than a Plymouth gin or a naval gin.
And all that means is that we don't add anything after it comes off the still. So there's a couple of things that you need to be able to do that we'd satisfy for it to be recognised London dry gin doesn't refer to the fact it's made in London or the fact that it's dry.
So no. What is the difference between London dry, Plymouth?
The stuff you make in your bath, Andrew, doesn't count.
I mean, the two main things are you have to use a minimum of 96% ethanol and you must leave it untouched other than adding more alcohol or water. You can't add anything else after it comes off the still. So they're all London dry gins. But to go back to your question, we bill this one as a London dry gin, which you're going to try next, because it harks back to a London dry recipe that would have been around 100, 150 years ago. So really juniper forward, lots of dry citrus notes. And the only sort of slight sort of modification to it that we've done is that there's a little bit of cardamom there, which gives a slightly different heat to what you might otherwise get.
Yeah, that's got a... There's a spiciness. It isn't just the juniper to that.
Yeah. This is made to be mixed with whatever tonic you like.
Yeah.
You still get that really nice punchy juniper notes.
Yeah.
And it celebrates what a gin can be mixed with anything, whether it's a Collins, whether it's in a gin sour, whatever it is. The main characteristics of a good gin, the dryness and the juniper, kind of sing through.
Raise your gimlet eye.
When you started your company, you need somebody with... skills and knowledge of this industry. Are there some of the people leaving the big boys of the industry because they're keen to move into this market? How do you find somebody who literally knows how to make a bottle of gin for you?
Well, I was introduced to someone called Jamie Baxter, who set up Chase, the master distiller there, and then was the master distiller at City of London Distillery. And I gave Jamie Baxter two lists of botanicals that I liked from a sort of palate balance, kind of flavor profile point of view. He said, I've got no idea about the ratio. So we played around for several months with these two different recipes. And the result was two gins that I thought were really good. So we did two instead of one.
We're right back to what's the difference between two gins. Now, what do you think about making gin and tonics? My favourite drink. I think you should have a lot of what you like in anything you make, whether you're cooking something. You need to have most of what you like in it. I would say, have two strong ones and four weak ones. Right?
I would say equal portions of gin to tonic.
Yeah. But that's the thing, isn't it? But people need to know how to make it, don't they?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the perfect serve in a gin and tonic for the next two gins you're going to try it, a very simple, easy to do at home, grapefruit peel for batch one to sort of bring out the grapefruit and a sage leaf for batch two.
So what are we having next?
So what are we having next? So we're going to start with batch one.
Andrew's so thirsty, isn't he?
It's been a hard day. We just did a new book, which is about... entrepreneurship. It's called The Monocle Guide to Good Business. And it's amazing how, especially in the zone of like food and drink, the entrepreneurial gusto of so many people starting companies, doing amazing, amazing things. Why is that? What's happened that so many of you are out there doing, setting up amazing businesses?
I think there's an appetite, particularly in London, for new innovative products, whether it's in the food industry, drinks industry or anything else.
I suppose it's good. It's a good test bed, isn't it? Because it's sort of wealthy, it's up for a laugh, and it's quite open to trying new things.
Yeah, and there's a sense of playfulness. And yes, we'll take a bottle of gin, Alex, and if we don't like it, we won't get another one, but we'll play around with it. Yeah. And there have been several bars that I've gone in and said, look, here's a bottle, this is how I think it might work. I won't be offended if you don't order it again, but try it and tell me what you think.
And Hackney seems to be the heartland of it all.
Yeah, I think Shoreditch now gets a bit of a bad rap. A lot of people feel like it's sort of slightly deteriorated, like Soho did probably 15, 20 years ago.
I moved out, so...
There you go.
But it's an interesting thing. I mean, are you a bit of a secret... I was going to say a secret shopper, but let's call you a secret drinker. Do you go to bars to see what people's experience of ordering your stuff is? Do you want to hear what people say about it?
I think the consumer, the drinker is key. Mm. I would never be prescriptive about how you must serve one or the other of the gins. It really is about what people want. In the distillery bar, we have probably 25, 30 gins there. Mm. And when people come in and say, I don't like gin, I say, well, fine, we'll start at one end and we'll give you a little bit of each one and we'll find your gin because it's so varied and it's so different. And then we'll talk about how you want to serve it. And do you want it in a martini? Do you want it in a Collins? I would never want to be prescriptive for the sake of maintaining some kind of, flavor profile or kind of aesthetic of the drink. The aesthetic and the taste of the drink is defined already. If someone wants to do something different with it, they can.
So the gin we've just had, that has much more of a burn. Alcohol top note is kind of what hits you.
It's a higher ABV, so it's 45% instead of 40%, which is the last one you tried. It's this sort of drier, aromatic gin. There's no lemon, there's just pink grapefruit, and the main sort of notes are that pink grapefruit and the Darjeeling. So the challenge of putting tea in any gin is that it doesn't become tannic and kind of cloying. And that long, dry note at the end is all about the tea. And the aroma and the sort of slightly sharpness of the pink grapefruit comes through. So, this is a kind of a great martini gin, really.
Yeah, yeah. particularly. It's got its dryness there already,
yeah,
hasn't it?
Exactly.
I don't know anything about whiskey. There's a whiskey shop just around the corner from here, and I went down there to buy a gift for a Burns night supper. Nice. The guy talked me through it, and so it's not sort of, you know, the pucker stuff unless it's 47% or something over.
Right.
Only at that alcoholic level do you get that colour, because everything else is coloured to make it that colour of a certain type. But what about this? What's the point in having something that's 47% other than 40?
Okay, so you could argue that the ABV is arbitrary. In this case, it's not. The ABV is increased based on the recipe because we want the alcohol to sort of pronounce and lift and carry the flavour profile a bit more so that you can dilute it in a martini and there is still that sense that the alcohol sort of showcasing what's going on.
You need the strength of the alcohol, presumably, to hold all the elements in place.
Exactly, yeah. The fact that one is higher than the other is the point, not that it's 2 or 3% more. It's the fact that it's with the one that I'm passing you now, which is batch two. Because the botanicals are much more contrasting and a bit more complex, you need that added lift of the alcohol.
Again, we're getting quite a collection of glasses here.
Wow, that's anywhere. So what's the notes in this that we're tasting then?
So the notes in this, you've got winter savory, you've got thyme, bay leaf, sage and lavender.
Oh, this is this one.
With the citrus, with the lemon as the citrus.
This feels like a proper Christmas drink.
Yeah.
But what's lovely about this is
Before
you meet the family.
And for you, the kind of the aspiration is how big do you want this to get? How do you look at the future?
In terms of the immediate future, we're sort of concentrating on seeding the gins in sort of the right places to get good feedback.
My kitchen's a great place. Well,
you can squabble over these four bottles. But yeah, no, it's in terms of getting into the right places where we can get feedback from customers, from bartenders, how versatile they are, how they're used, what the brand calling is, what people like to have with them. And we've been quite careful about having sort of perfect serves with them because the idea of a perfect serve is great, but it kind of, it's a little bit prescriptive.
It maybe puts people off that they can't take it home and make as nice a drink.
Yeah.
Or it's not a party drink, it's for special occasions or something like that.
Yeah, and the other side of what we're doing is that we really want to make it accessible. So in terms of price point.
Yeah, well, what's the price point?
So under £20. These are £18 each, and this is 26 and 27. So although it all looks, I mean, obviously I'm totally biased, but although it looks premium in terms of aesthetic, in terms of layout, in terms of the way it's put together, in terms of the way it tastes too, price-wise it's not.
I'd just like to point out that horse is upside down.
It's still upside down.
I know. Well, I love all of those. I don't know which one I like
Robert,
the most.
So it's when you have the bottle in your mouth up the other way and the horse is the right way. You've got to get
right
worried.
Way up now. I really like that. I like the wintry one, actually. I quite like a bit of rosemary. Rub that around the rim of a gin and tonic as well. And that's got that kind of Italian herbaceous thing going on with it. It's really good. I love that one. I guess that listeners, not just in London, but all our international listeners, will find a bottle on a bar near there.
And just before you go, you've got a cocktail bar, haven't you, as well?
We have. We've got a cocktail bar and we're opening a bottle shop next door. So there'll be a place to buy gin and lots of other different...
Normally we do the plug. We'll let you do the plug. Where do people find out more about you? Is there a website?
There is. It's eastlondonliquorcompany.com. And we will start making whiskey next month. So we'll be the first distillery north of the river in over 150 years to be making whiskey in London, which is exciting.
I think you'll find Rob in the queue.
But until then, all our products are available to be bought over the bar or in the bottle shop.
Well, it's lovely stuff. Best of luck with it. Not that you need it. And maybe we'll have to, I think maybe a whiskey tasting near a Christmas time, Andrew, don't you?
That sounds perfect.
Alex Woolpert from the East London Liquor Company. Thank you very much for joining us. Feel better or worse now at the end of the show than you did at the beginning?
I feel cheered. I feel oddly lightheaded about the world.
What's your favourite of the drinks?
Well, certainly the gin.
Yeah.
And I think you like batch two, but I like batch one.
Did you?
Yes.
Yeah. What's your chosen canapé? What would you have with it? You're a nut man, crisp.
More nut than crisp. But not olive and a nut.
Mm. I like an olive if it's in a martini. I'm not really into it. I don't like to have that served. I like a nut.
I don't really like seeing all the stones all over the table either. No. Anyway, a nut. A nice salty nut.
Sweet as a nut. We hope you agreed. That was edition 271 of the Monocle Weekly. It was produced by Isabel Kayser and our studio manager was Claire Urban. And we'll be here again same time next week. But for the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And me, Andrew Tuck.
Thanks for tuning in.